It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Day before Halloween, Halloween Eve, I guess, if you want to call it that. And I think DOTD is messing with my mind because when I drove across the Crescent City Connection about an hour and a half ago, it was lit up in pink, and now it's purple and green, it looks like, or blue and green. I think it changed. I don't know. If y'all were driving around, let me know, because maybe I'm losing my mind, maybe not. I don't know, maybe it's the campaign. Anyway, hot really throughout Halloween, warm and humid and no cold front and on the horizon. So be aware of that. Maybe a chance for showers on Halloween, as they say. Check the radar before you go out. We're going to talk about infant care. How much does it cost around the country? Alex Gailey joins us now, lead data reporter at Bankrate. Good morning, Alex. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Tell me what it is that Bankrate studied here. What are we talking about?
We looked at the percentage of income that a typical family in each state would have to allocate to afford average infant care costs. And for the purposes of our study, we considered average prices for full-time daycare for one infant. And what we found is that in 48 states and the District of Columbia, daycare full-time for one infant costs families at least 10% of their income.
What effect does that have on the individual families? What effect does it have on the economy?
Childcare is expensive, it's hard to find, and even harder to afford, which can have a significant impact on the economy. I've seen research and estimates that the U.S. economy could be losing out on billions per year because of high childcare costs, and it does have a ripple effect on families, businesses, and the workforce. Families feel financially constrained, which in turn affects their spending, and we know that consumer spending makes up a large portion of the U.S. GDP. When the cost of childcare is high, businesses can lose workers, particularly women, who decide it may make more financial sense for them to stop working and stay home to be caregivers. And that ultimately affects who is in the workforce, too.
So as we talk about this, it strikes me that I would think the price of childcare is relatively fixed, although you can opt for the premium if you want. Everybody wants the best for their kids, naturally. But the income does not go up on a sliding scale, as does the price of childcare. If that's fixed, people that are making $100,000 a year are going to have a lot less problem than somebody making $20,000 a year and trying to go to work.
Yeah, so when we looked at estimates across the country, childcare costs do vary based on cost of living, that state's supply and demand for childcare, and likely the makeup of their workforce. And ultimately, in places that are more expensive, like New York and Hawaii, costs are really high. Income is also higher, but even with higher income, we're talking a typical family still having to allocate maybe around 20% of their income just to afford full-time daycare for one infant. Now, infant care tends to be the costliest across age groups, but even when I looked at the data for other age groups, the costs for full-time care don't go down that significantly as children age, really up until, you know, they get to that point where they can go to school. And so it is still eating into a big portion of families' budgets, really for years, and it can affect their ability to save, invest, and pay down debt.
So are we talking about birth to what in this study? 4 or 5?
Birth to up to 12 months old. So really focused on that first year. But there is estimates for toddler care, for 4-year-olds. And while those costs decrease little by little. They're still significant. They're thousands of dollars annually for full-time care.
I would think at some point, and look, we're talking about the economic effects here. There are certainly social effects and psychological effects and everything else having a child. I don't know if you have kids or not, but it'll change your life completely and totally, especially that first year. When it comes to lost productivity, did this study look at that at all or not?
We did not look at lost productivity, but that is a huge problem in the childcare industry, is that the childcare industry is treated as a private market and it has struggled to grow and be profitable, and it has struggled with productivity. There's a lot of turnover, staffing shortages in the childcare industry because childcare workers are paid fairly low, within the 5% of all occupations in the U.S. In terms of wages. So productivity is certainly a huge issue in the child care industry and trying to increase that. And that's ultimately why costs have risen so much over the last three decades, over 1.5 times faster than overall inflation.
Well, you know, when you look at the work that, and this is just an aside, I guess, Alex, when you look at the work that those caring for elderly people in nursing homes and the importance of the work that those caring for infants and the compensation that they receive, boy, we have a big problem in this country, don't we?
Yes, it is a significant issue for child care providers to be earning, you know, fair wages and to be, you know, valued in the workforce. And it's the same, it's a similar issue for those who take care of our elders as well. And that ultimately comes down to the fact that the child care industry has razor thin profit margins. 70 to 80% of costs of child care is really due to staff costs, because providers need high ratios of adults to children for basic health and safety reasons. There's also a lot of regulation in the child care industry, even though it is a private market, which can make, you know, makes things more costly when you're having to make sure you're staffed enough to stay open and you're following regulation or rules within your state and federally.
And let's talk about some solutions maybe when we come back, or ways to make it better. We're talking to Alex Gailey, lead data reporter at Bankrate. She talks about a lot of things with the economy. Today we're talking about their study as it relates to the high cost of infant child care. And I would ask you, text me at 504-260-1870. If you're a grandparent or a parent and you have an infant, how do you handle that first year? Or how did you handle that first year of childcare? Was it a family member? Did you find somebody you trusted? And how much of a bite out of your budget did it take? 621 Traffic Now, WWL. 624, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Gailey, lead data reporter for Bankrate. You can follow her on Twitter at Alex_Gailey. Did I say that right, Alex?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Thank you.
And you know it's her because she's got a big coffee cup that she's holding. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Because they got other Alex Gaileys. That's the only reason I said that, so people get the right one. So we were talking earlier about the high cost of childcare, and this is especially bad in New York. Is that what the study showed?
Yeah, so there are states where infant care specifically is more affordable and less affordable. And the states that were least affordable were New Mexico, Hawaii, and New York. We didn't take policy reform and regulation into account in this study. So while New Mexico is the least affordable for infant care, New Mexico has enacted some policy in the last few years that has tried to make childcare more accessible for most families, virtually free for a lot of families in New Mexico. And with New York specifically, I mean, a typical family there would spend around 20% of their income for full-time daycare for one infant if they don't qualify for any subsidies.
This is a little bit off the subject, but one thing, having been to New York a couple of different times, I don't understand how, like, for example, let's just take, for example, you know, in Times Square, the stores or whatever, where they got the security guys and the blue blazers, right? They can't make that much money, but yet it costs a lot of money to live in New York. So I don't understand how that model works, or for anybody really that's not making a lot of money in New York. How is it survivable? What am I missing, Alex?
Well, in New York, we looked at the state level. Of course, where you live specifically in New York is going to make a huge difference. If you live in upstate New York, affordability is going to look a lot different for you than if you live in the city. I know that I've seen research for New York City that has talked a lot about just the child care crisis in New York City specifically, and having to be a lot of demand but not enough supply, and costs going through the roof. Really what it comes down to when you live in a higher cost of living is trying to increase your income to be able to survive and live off of that cost of living in that area. But a lot of parents are having to get creative with their budgets to afford childcare. They're cutting costs. They're budgeting meticulously. They're finding ways to increase their income through side hustles. Common cost cutting strategies could be limiting vacations or shopping only what's on sale that week at the grocery store. I mean, people are having to get really creative to afford childcare.
I like to get the audience involved. Somebody texted in and said, childcare like college has doubled in price because more and more government subsidies. Duh. Is there any evidence to indicate any of that at all?
Yeah, it's a great question on what is kind of contributing to rising costs. Based on the policy experts that I spoke to, what they pointed to was the fact that childcare industry actually has very limited state and federal funding, which ultimately squeezes both childcare providers, who then passes those costs off to families seeking care. Really on both sides, supply and demand, everyone is stretched pretty thin and to their maximum when it comes to child care. And like I said earlier, really the cost of child care, the high cost of it is really due to those staff costs. A lot of that is going to the fact that we need higher ratios of adults to children. But the dilemma is that those people that are entering those industries are not getting paid well.
So, don't let me hurt myself here economically, because, I had close to 9 hours of it in college. But when it comes to the demand, there's a lot of demand that's chasing too few goods or too few services when it comes to child care. However, the market forces can't work because there's not enough money behind the demand, but it's not, I'm really going to show off here, it's not elastic or inelastic, whichever one it is, because you need child care. It's not like that's something you can do without, right? So this seems like a puzzle that's hard to put together. Did I mess anything up?
Yes, it's a really complex issue, and it's something that families are not willing to sacrifice on quality of, rightfully so. You want your child to go to the best child care provider that you can afford within your budget. So it's a cost that a lot of families are willing to eat and take because they want the best for their children. And it's not optional, especially if you don't have family that you can rely on. It's something that you have to figure out in your budget, and you have to cut back in other areas to afford it.
So the traditional model, whatever one it is, supply, demand, market forces, that really is not a resolution here, because it's not something that you can do without, and people make a fixed amount of money, and the daycare people, there's not a lot of incentive to expand or to hire employees and pay a lot more because there's only so much people can pay, right?
That's what I've been told by policy experts that I've spoken to on this issue, is exactly that, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Alex. I appreciate your time, and we'll have you back to talk about some other research that you've done, all right?
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too. Alex Gailey, lead data reporter at Bankrate. You can follow her on Twitter at Alex, A-L-E-X, underscore G-A-I-L-E-Y. She got some interesting things posted there. We come back, we're going to talk to Leah Long, director of the Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, about the special session, small businesses, and taxes. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Leah Long, director of the Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. How are you, Ms. Long?
Hey, good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Okay, it's okay to call you Leah or Leah?
Yeah, Leah. Leah's okay. Fine.
Let's talk about, man, I was talking to Newell Norman yesterday about inventory taxes, and he was the, what do you call this, officios tax collector, whatever they, however they phrase it, for Sheriff of Jefferson Parish. And he tried to explain the inventory tax and the tax credits and how, I guess, and then people were texting in about, with the inventory tax. Apparently, you inflate the inventory, or some places do inflate the inventory once a year, and then that's in order to get state tax credit. I don't understand how any of this works. Take me through it.
Well, for us, inventory tax, obviously, we're looking at that because it does help locals. I know that the plan is something the locals can either opt in or opt out, and I think if they opt out, then they're out for good, basically forever until we ever do anything
with taxes. Go slow. What do you mean, local governments?
So local government, I think they get, obviously, tax money from inventory tax. And so they're going to be able to opt in or opt out. So if they opt out, they're going to be able to, I think, collect $15 million, which is the cap that I think the state's going to give them.
In credits.
And so in credits, yes. So they can, I'm pretty sure from what Richard Nelson was saying, that they can get that in a lump sum of $15 million, or they could kind of split it up. And then if they opt in, they're going to be able to stay in and collect inventory tax.
So, let me go slow, Dawn, because, again, I don't know anything about any of this. I don't think a lot of the listeners do either. They don't own small businesses, so I'm trying to understand this. When you say $15 million, that's not everybody so gets $15 million. That's the cap.
Everyone.
Yeah, okay.
That's the cap, yeah. Right. Like smaller parishes, obviously, if there's not a lot of businesses in that area, businesses that have a ton of inventory, they're not probably getting that 15. But if you think about like the river parishes that have a lot of, the big companies, that kind of stuff, that are going to have a lot of inventory on hand, they're probably getting more. So I know that's one thing the locals have kind of talked about to the state and talked to LDR about. And that's one of those things that, we're interested in, we're looking at, because obviously some of our businesses do have inventory and they're going to have to be on top of that. But one of the biggest things for us, though, that we've been looking at is obviously lowering the personal income tax rate. That's kind of our biggest thing. That's always been a big thing because most of the small businesses file their taxes as pass-through entities. And so that's one thing. We're just kind of monitoring the plan right now. We're looking at it, which everyone always says that, the bills coming in on November 6th may not look the same on November 25th. Mm-hmm. And so far, our biggest issue is, the sales tax. It's not really an issue, but it's just an admin issue that, these small business owners that have not ever had to collect or remit taxes, they're going to have to do that if they fall in those 41 categories of services. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of education done to teach business owners how to do it. I mean, thinking about me myself, you tell me, hey, I need to collect sales tax on something, I don't know where the first place to start. You know what I mean? So a business owner that's never had to do it, they're going to have to learn how to do it.
You think you don't know where to start? I'm asking you to explain it to me. So when you
the
whole idea behind this reform package, as I understand it, is to shift it from income tax to more of a sales tax. Accurate?
Yes, shifting it from that to be able to lower your income tax, basically.
So
expanding that on the services. Lowering the corporate tax rate down to 3.5 or 3% also. So just going toward a flat rate. So it's basically shifting it from income taxes down to, service taxes. There's different things on there, getting rid of inventory tax. Basically, it's just a package to lower your income tax rate.
So what the members of the organization, what do they think is going to help them more? Lowering personal income tax, which gives people more money to spend, or lowering sales tax, because if you lower income tax and raise sales tax, they have more money to spend, but they're spending it on sales tax. Am I oversimplifying this or not?
No, I mean, that's basically pretty much how simple it is. I mean, money works. You get more money, you spend it on more if goods and services cost more. You know what I mean? But we're working with our members. We're polling them, kind of see where they're at. But right now, we're just kind of watching it. Like I said earlier, this may not be what comes out of the final picture on November 25th and what makes it to Jeff Landry's desk. And so it's just one of those monitoring, because we want to make Louisiana better to do business in. We want to make people be able to grow their businesses here. And, if this package somehow helps do that and we can all come to a middle ground on things, then that's a great thing, because we want to make Louisiana succeed.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Leah Long, director of Louisiana chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, about the governor's tax reform program. We're going to talk tomorrow, I think, with Richard Nelson, the revenue secretary, try to get the details from him. And I'll do some more homework to try to understand all of this. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:54, 6 till 7. Now the DOTD is just playing mind games with me because now the Crescent City Connection lights are purple and gold. They started at pink. They went to green and purple, I think. Now they're purple and gold. That or I'm losing my mind. Leah Long, Director of Louisiana Chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Now that I think about it, it could be both, right? They could be changing lights, and I could be losing my mind as well. They're not mutually exclusive. Speaking of losing your mind, I think the last time you and I spoke, you were getting ready to pour through that binder of the initial plan. I can't even begin to imagine, because we said earlier that it was almost as simple as you lower the personal income tax side so you give people more to spend, but you're still taking it right back because you're charging them sales tax. How does that make it a more favorable environment for people to come in and do business? Or are there things that aren't being discussed, the devil in the details, that I'm not understanding here? Talk to me about that, Leah.
Well, a lot of it is going to be the devil in details when it's the final legislation that comes out. But, you know, for a small business owner operating in, you know, operating in Louisiana or wanting to move to Louisiana, if they do file, as you know, they file the personal level. And so in reality, yeah.
No, wait, I don't know that at all. What do you mean they file at the personal level?
Okay. So they file a pass-through entity. So the money that they pay, make in their business, they file on a personal income tax rate. Okay. Most of them do. Typically they do. I would say about majority of our members do their LLCs or, you know, they file as the personal income tax rate mm-hmm. every year. And so, you know, if that rate is lower, that is going to benefit them in the end. And so I think that's kind of a mindset, but also all the other states around us. And I know this is a big push from the governor's office and Richard Nelson's office, just because, you know, to stay competitive in the South, we have the highest personal income tax rate right now. You know, Mississippi's lowering theirs. Arkansas just lowered theirs. So I think it's, you know, to attract people to not only live here, but do business here, because you hear about Texas all the time. You know, they have no personal income tax rate. You know, we're always trying to compete with Texas. But I love how Secretary Bourgeois always says, you know, it's perception. You know, mm-hmm. it's not about actual reality. It's perception. Yeah, Texas seems better, but they also have a lot of other things that we don't have too, that, you know,
taxes.
May help our businesses. Yeah, property taxes, that kind of stuff. But they all love to create an environment for Louisiana. You know, everyone can make more money here and their businesses can do well here. But it is where it does shift from, you know, income tax to sales tax. And, you know, they sell it as these are optional items. Some of them are, but there's going to be a lot of devil in the details when it comes to educating these business owners. You know, how do I collect my sales tax? How do I remit it? And there's a lot of different things. You know, I think it's one of them is remodeling, I think, is actually on there. So it's, you know, these business owners that own a construction company or if they do HVAC work or something like that, you know, being able to decide, okay, this isn't a new build, so I don't have to, this is a new build, so I don't have to charge sales tax on that. But if you're doing remodeling or home installation or something like that, so I think it's going to be about how you educate these business owners to be able to even, you know, comply with that and be able to collect the revenue they're wanting to from the sales tax. That's a big thing too. You know, they've put these numbers in to assume like this is how much they're going to collect. And so to do that, you need to educate the business owners and make sure that they know how to do it correctly so we're not in another budget shortfall and all this plan works out.
So something just kind of clicked in my head. The light bulb went off when you talked about small business owners filing personally and lowering the personal income tax rate. I looked at lowering the income tax rate as a way of getting people to move here when, in fact, that's mm-hmm. not what it is. It's about business owners and the tax that they pay on their profits. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, it's also about moving here, too. You want to move to a state that, you know, you talk to people that live in California and, you know, they want to move to somewhere that, you know, obviously is better than California, but also, you know, where they're going to be able to keep more of their money. The ideal goal of being American, obviously, keep more money in your pocket instead
right.
of paying it to government.
But there are also a lot of other considerations, right, about
yeah,
where you live?
Yeah, a lot of other considerations, yeah. too. But, you know, being able to lower it so these people have more money, they actually, you know, can put more money back in their business. And that's one of the things I think as a small business owner, a lot of these people, yeah, they're making profits with their business, but they're also, like, that's their money that they've made also. So they're putting it back into their business. And so I think when you think about a small business owner, it's not a big corporation. You know, this is their money that they've made all year and they can turn around and invest it back into their business to expand or, you know, do some renovation on their business to make it better.
Yeah, I was just talking about the incentive portion of it primarily is what I was asking.
Yeah, I mean, the different incentives, which I think that's something LED is going through, you know, different sides of that. But yeah, an incentive of owning a business and doing a business, you know, and starting one here is if it does have a...
And being able to keep more of your well-earned
keep
profits.
More. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah,
right?
Keep more to be able to have a business in Louisiana. And if is the income tax rate is lower, that is more of an incentive to own a business here.
Starts on November 6th, got to end by November 25th. You think that's enough time to get through all of this?
That's a fast 20 days,
yeah.
So we'll see. But I know it's going to move fast. Everyone's anticipating that it's going to you're going to come in and we're going to rock and roll. And the good thing about it is, you know, they want to get this done. It's going to go on the ballot in March. But you turn around in April, there's a fiscal session. And I heard people say, Yesha, you know, if something doesn't work out correctly or we need to make changes, we're going to turn around after Article 7's on the ballot, if it passes or fails, and then be able to come in April for a fiscal session. And hopefully if there's anything that needs to be changed or we need to update, we'll be able to do that then, too.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, Leah Long. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Zee Zerang about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion and the delays and the mess that it has become. Back in a flash, WWL.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Unseasonably warm, really. Normally around Halloween, you hope you get that first cold front, but not in the next 10 days or so. Highs going to be in the lower 80s, nary a chance for rain except for tomorrow. And Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana forecaster, saying maybe check the radar on that. Not a washout, but you might have a shower or two around trick-or-treat time. Jerome Zee Zerang joins us, Louisiana State Representative, talk about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion as we continue to talk about this because it continues to be stalled and the clock continues to tick, and there are other issues as well in addition to the coastal restoration issues. Hey, Zee, how are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm great. How are you?
I wish they'd get going on this thing. Let's talk about this letter that, as I understand it, the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the Department of the Interior, the Department of Agriculture, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency sent to the state of Louisiana about the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion.
That's right. Yeah, the TIG, which is the Louisiana Trustee Implementation Group, they're kind of responsible to ensure, as part of the NERDA process, that is responsible for mitigating the impacts for the oil spill, to ensure that good projects that mitigate for those impacts and the dollars being used are put to good use. So they sent a letter to Louisiana a couple weeks ago, essentially saying fish are cut bait. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is they've committed to this project. And quite frankly, if I were a commercial recreational fisherman, not just living in Plaquemine Parish, but people who live in Louisiana, I want a copy of this letter, and I would be concerned, because if you look at the letter, basically what they're saying is, listen, we're committed to the TIG, and the NERDA group is committed to this project. Why is it Louisiana? And it's been one of the most researched projects. Even in the letter, they recognize that there is no single restoration project plan that has been studied more extensively over the past decade, few decades, than Louisiana's proposed Mid-Barataria sediment diversion project. And more importantly, if you look at what the project, the benefits it's going to have, they keep talking about it's going to destroy the fisheries. It's completely untrue. And they have the science and the research to back it up. But it's also going to protect Louisiana communities and infrastructure, reduce impacts from storms, and support healthier Gulf fisheries. So if I'm interested in white shrimp, red drum, and blue crab, that's going to help those resources. What's happening right now is a select group of special interest or influencing a parish and encouraging them to stop or halt this project because of their own special selfish interests that are stopping this. And another important aspect of this, if I lived in Plaquemines Parish, and if I lived in Grand Bayou, this project is going to reduce flooding in Grand Bayou. It also says that Myrtle Grove, Wood Park, Susie Bayou, Hermitage, Grand Bayou, and Happy Jack, if I lived in any of those communities, it says that they will experience
more flooding. You broke up, Z, but I'll pick it up. They'll experience more flooding without the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion and the associated community stewardship measures than with them. Are you still with us? Z, your phone broke up. I'm going to go ahead and read the last paragraph of this letter, which is really attention-getting, and it says, if Louisiana decides not to pursue the project as evaluated and designed, the federal trustees expect the state will cease spending allocated TIG funds immediately and return those funds for future restoration activities. Given the gravity of this situation, we cannot overstate the importance of continued transparent communication with Louisiana TIG trustees and with the affected public. We look forward to hearing CPRA's position regarding the MBSD Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion Project. So they're saying Myrtle Grove, just to recap what this letter says, Wood Park, Susie Bayou, Hermitage, Grand Bayou, Happy Jack, will all experience more flooding without the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion and the associated community stewardship measures than with them. And, of course, I read the last paragraph of the letter. Z, I've seen things recently that, the fishermen are saying, well, maybe it is a good thing, but we need to be compensated more other than the measures, I think, $718 million, is that what it is, or $817 million? How much has been set aside for them?
Well, it's close to $300 million to $350 million that are set aside to mitigate. They're going to acquire properties, acquire.
You're breaking up. See, we got to get this fixed up so I can hear what you have to say. But I thought there was money to offset, and I'll look this up, money to offset the fishermen or to help them out. And I guess what got my attention about that was it seemed as though, Z, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Z, you got to pay the bill, buddy. If you look, you if you're on hard times and AT&T is threatening to cut you off, just reach out. I'll help you out. You know what I mean? No, but seriously, I see where I thought there was money that was like $700 million or something that was dedicated, or is that what they're looking for to help them offset their losses, the oyster fishermen, et cetera?
Yes, Tommy. There's $350 million that's set aside to mitigate for impacts, to acquire and buy out properties, but also to mitigate for commercial interests that will be impacted. But there's also going to be a significant improvement in some aspects of fisheries as well. So in addition, the irony about this is the fact that the parish is using certification of the flood insurance program to stop or halt this project when it's obvious that this project is going to prevent flooding in a lot of these communities. And if I were in those communities, I'd be asking the parish, why are they stopping or holding up this project?
Because what and we'll pick it up when we come back, is what it seems like is the tone has changed of the fishermen from, okay, it's a good thing scientifically, but we need more money because we got to go back to where we originally started going. And look, I got nothing against oyster fishermen. I tell you this before, Z. I lived down the street from Mitch Jurisich's son with Louisiana Oyster Task Force. I know all of these people. I know Keith Hinkle, all of them. But I just want to do what's best for everybody and not just for a specific interest. And if you're saying that it was going to destroy the environment, but now you're saying it's not, and now you're holding the whole thing up for compensation, that doesn't seem like it's in the best interest of everybody. But we'll talk more when we come back. Z Zarang, our guest, Louisiana State Representative, talking about the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion. 721 Traffic Now, WWL. Man, just once I'd like to hear that guy say, you might be a redneck if. 726, we're talking to Jerome Zarang, Louisiana State Representative. I'm Tommy Tucker here on WWL about the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion. I don't know where I got $700 million from, but $305 million has been set aside. Maybe they're looking for more. Either way, Talk about the delays with this thing. Where do we stand? I don't even know where it is now. It's so many suits have been filed and counteroffers and delays, and now this letter from the TIG people. Where do we stand, Jerome?
Well, unfortunately, we stand with the fact of the matter is they're asking for transparency within the process. But when you go to the CPRA, they're basically saying, well, it's in the courts. It's in the courts. We can't talk about it. Well, it's time to get past that. We're allowing the parish to hold up this project. And quite frankly, the state should respond to this letter. It's been 2 weeks.
I don't know if you're moving around or not, but I sure wish you'd stop.
I'm sorry, Tommy.
Okay.
My phone's acting up.
Stay right where you are. Don't move, and maybe we can get through this.
Okay.
So,
okay, and
the reality is, go ahead.
So the reality is the parish is holding up this project. They stayed the stop work order so that they could move forward in certain aspects of the project. But the problem is they've done that, and now we need to move past this and begin the project one way or the other. If it's in the courts and we need to resolve this by litigation, then heck, the state needs to move forward and begin the process and litigate this. But we can't and shouldn't allow the parish and select special interests to stop this major project. In addition to all the benefits that it's going to have to the resource and the communities there, think of the economic boom that it's going to provide to the parish, a $3 billion project in the parish. I mean, if I lived in that parish, I'd be all excited about trying to get this done. Apart from the benefits it's going to have, the economic impact is going to be substantial.
It seems like everything changed when Governor Landry came in, put Gordon Dove as the head of the CPRA, and that it seems as though the interests of commercial fishermen are being put ahead of the greater good as far as this project goes, that compromise is not science, and as we've talked about before, science and politics never make for good bedfellows. Building a smaller diversion is going to be the worst of both worlds for everybody. That's going to be a disaster. I presume that's also going to jeopardize the federal funding, is it not?
Well, yes. They basically said that in the letter, essentially that they've evaluated this project. They looked at six different alternatives. And this, after all the extensive research over a decade, this is the project we need to implement. Anything less than that is going to have to be started all over again. It's going to delay and jeopardize future funding for restoration projects. So this is the project that needs to happen, and we can work to minimize the impacts in operating the system. But because of the benefits it's going to have, it should move forward. And quite frankly, the parish, we have to look at this, but they can and should be held liable. Ultimately, if we have to give back the money, and that's what the letter is asking for, if you're not going to move forward, you need to stop spending money, and you're going to have to give back what you didn't spend. But the state's going to be on the hook for this, and I think that we should look at maybe the liability associated with this as who's responsible for paying that money back, and it shouldn't be the state.
So who can do what at this point to move this along or get it through the courts or get a decision? Or where the ball is in whose court, Z?
Well, two things. So right now the TIG is asking for a response to the letter, so the state needs to respond to this letter. And they need to advance this effort. The AG's office is representing the state. If they're saying it has to be litigated, then the AG's office needs to advance this and resolve this issue. And I think some people are saying that, you know, some are saying that the intent is to wait and see if President Trump will win. And then if he wins, then they will try to influence or affect this project. That may or may not be the case. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But the reality is we need to move past this. The federal government is asking for a response and a commitment from the state, and we need to move forward on this project.
Thank you, Z. Appreciate your time and your efforts as always. We'll talk to you again soon. I'm sure Z Zerang, Jerome Zerang, Louisiana State Representative, talking about the science behind the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion. I've listened to a lot of stuff about this throughout the years, and it sure seems like special interests are holding up a project for the greater good. 7:30, time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Dr. Kim Reed, Commissioner of Higher Education in Louisiana. Good morning, Dr. Reed. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. As the, for people that don't know, because you've got a lot of people with a lot of different titles, as the Commissioner of Higher Education, what is it that you do?
Well, my best job, obviously, is advocating for the students of our state and trying to make sure that more of them, whether they're young or young at heart, have the opportunity to get a great credential, whether that's at a two-year institution or a four-year institution in our state. So the advocacy and policy work is the best work on behalf of our students.
Tell me what your concerns are. Well, first of all, let's talk about the importance of I guess students who need skills, opportunities, credentials to enter the world of work. First of all, the importance of having them, and then we'll talk about the concern that maybe they won't be able to get them.
Sure. You know, when we think about this knowledge economy, we think about technology, AI, the skills and competencies that are required to navigate the world of work. The credential of some sort beyond high school, a credential of value beyond high school, is a prerequisite into employment today. And so we're trying to make sure that more students understand and start early on skill building and earning credentials. It's our responsibility, obviously, to make sure it's affordable and equitable for students. But we have case making to do to make sure that our citizens understand that there's a place for them at one of our institutions and how important it is, Tommy, to start and to finish that credential.
Where does funding for that stand now, and what are your concerns moving forward, Dr. Reed?
So we are in a situation where we've been asked to prepare for budget cuts in higher education, between $100 million and $250 million in budget cuts, a worst-case scenario that the administration and the legislature has asked us to do. We've had our September budget hearings with the system presidents. They've talked about the devastating impact of cuts of up to 23-24%. But this is state general funds. These are the dollars that come from taxpayers' hard work that are allocated to higher education. We are unprotected in the Constitution along with health care. So anytime the budget of the state is waning or dollars are scarce, they look to higher education and health care as potentially on the chopping block. That is our concern. We need more education, not less, in our state. But with budget cuts, you will end up with less opportunity.
You know what this reminds me of, Dr. Reed, is the old business saying that you can't save your way into a profit. Is that kind
and
of
you can't cut your way to excellence,
that's
right?
That's what I'm saying. It seems like, so we have a poverty level. Now we're talking about cutting higher ed, which is not going to do anything to increase that poverty level. You can talk about income tax reform all you want. But if you don't have an educated workforce, then I don't know how changing the tax code is going to make people want to come and move the business here. It's all interrelated, is it not?
It's absolutely interrelated. You absolutely are correct that we have to have skills and opportunities to move people out of poverty. But we also want the legislature to know and our citizens to advocate for this. When we do our job well, we create more taxpayers. We create more people who are contributing to the economy, and that will continue to improve our state and the prosperity of our state and our people. So we want people to understand that we're more than just an expenditure or a line on a budget. We are an investment in our people. We are an investment in Louisiana's future. So that's the case that we will be making to the legislature and the governor as we continue through this process.
What's going on with dual enrollment and who's paying for what?
Dual enrollment is an opportunity for high school students to start earning college credit while they're still in high school. We have about 41,000 students who are participating in our public colleges and universities, a fantastic number. We've been growing that program. But again, another program that could be in jeopardy if there are budget cuts. We have requested additional dollars, $20 million in funding, to ensure that every high school junior and senior could take a dual enrollment course at no cost to the family. That's our goal, to increase access. But if we have budget cuts, institutions may choose not to offer dual enrollment. And so, you know, it's a program that could be diminished instead of expand it when we need more expansion.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. We're talking to Dr. Kim Reed, Commissioner Louisiana of Commissioner of Higher Education, Louisiana. They've been told to prepare for. Was that accurate, Dr. Reed? Told to prepare or, yeah, that's the phrase, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Prepare to $150 million budget cut. Correct.
Up to $150 to $200 million in budget cuts. We'll talk about what that could look like to specific schools or specific areas when we come back. 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, talking to Dr. Kim Reed, Commissioner of Higher Education, Louisiana. She's been told to prepare for, in her department, $150 to $200 million in potential budget cuts. Dr. Reed, how do you even go about parsing that out or deciding, triaging what gets cut, what doesn't, what gets funded, what doesn't? How do you even begin to do that?
Well, it's a painful exercise, but if we don't make the case, Tommy, if we don't explain that a potential cut of that magnitude, 23%, 24%, what that looks like for students, for affordability, for completers, layoffs for faculty, staff, potential satellite campus closures, if we don't explain that, then people won't understand the urgency of addressing the issue. So what we do every year in September is we ask the system presidents of the four systems, LSU, Southern, the Community Technical College system, and the UL system, to come forward and explain both the impact of cuts and what they need to do their job even better. And so we have informed information because it's coming from the campus and system leaders who are in this work every single day.
So it's one thing on an Excel spreadsheet, right, or a budget that you prepare. But it's something else when you talk about everyday life and what it's like for potential students or the schools themselves. What would that look like, Dr. Reed?
Well, it certainly would look like less access. So I would imagine that you'll have some satellite campus closures, less faculty and staff because of layoffs. So that means less services to students, less courses available to students, harder to complete. Certainly, I would imagine it would mean that higher education would be less affordable at a time when we need it to be more affordable than ever before. But I appreciate your comment, Tommy, because it's not numbers. This is about people. And our people need more education and training than ever before. They need the opportunity to get these credentials to go to work. And budget cuts provide dramatic barriers to opportunity in a state that needs more opportunity for our people.
I get one gadfly apparently that's texting in about the money's being wasted, this, that, the other thing. How important is it to have, because nothing just happens, right? And I always go back, Dr. Reed, to if you're a volunteer parent, which I have been, chairs at a meeting just don't appear. They got to be set up by somebody. They got to be picked up by somebody, right? And that's the lowest bar example I can think of. So along those lines, things in a state, things in an economy just don't happen. You know, if you build it, they will come, but you got to have an educated workforce. How far down the line would budget cuts like this affect an educated workforce, the state's economy, and having an educated workforce available for the next several years?
It would certainly impact the work. There is a commitment and a consistent focus right now on increasing labor force participation. The estimate is that we have one of the lowest workforce participation rates in the nation. And so, again, you're working against your mission and you're working against your goal. The goal is to get more people credentialed, more people working, more people paying taxes. But budget cuts would mean that you would have less opportunity to do that. But I do want to specifically answer the question about wasted money and efficiency. Mm-hmm. Higher education in Louisiana has been one of the lowest funded in the nation. Today, our funding is at the 2012 level of funding in terms of state funds. In 2012, we had less employees, but today we have more graduates.
And a lot has changed since then. Dr. Reed, you got to come back.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated. Where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
8:15 Wednesday morning. We generally talk to Ronald Surpass around that time, around these parts. Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola. Former NOPD superintendent, head of the Washington State Police, Nashville City Police, consultant to many departments, and I believe... by now, you probably got all the glitter washed off your face from the Taylor Swift concert, right?
I did. I was right there at the stage. It was amazing.
It is.
I'm just too exhausted to speak about it.
I'll tell you this, that man, that glitter, once you get out in the house, you'll never get it out of there. Never. You'll have that there forever. Let's talk about the test that was given. I talked to Captain Glasser about this last Friday, I think it was. And the mayor getting involved in who gets promoted and who doesn't. Take me back to when, I don't know if I talked to you about this last week or not, but when the tests were given, when you were superintendent, how you handled all of that, how the mayor then handled all of that.
The history has been that the New Orleans Civil Service Department, since the mid-80s, has conducted the promotional examinations. They do so with great professionalism. They do so with great protection of the data. It's gotten more sophisticated. New Orleans is not unique at all in this. Departments around the country have been doing this for decades. So when the Civil Service Commission produces a list, there's different rules that you can use to operate on the list, but you're basically tethered to the list that Civil Service produces. There is always complaints, Tommy, in promotions and transfers, and it's just the way things are, that if you thought you were going to be promoted and it didn't happen for you, sometimes you'll create a narrative that you were cheated. If you didn't get a transfer you were hoping to get, sometimes you'll create a narrative, hey, it was my fault, I need to do better. So the notion that this police department is any different than any police department in the country to suggest that some people are not satisfied with the promotional list is not new. But here is something new. While we were in office, I do not remember, and so I could be corrected, but I do not remember this imposed by consent decree requirement that for captains and majors, for example, a group of three deputy chiefs would do an external ranking based on internal documents and experiences above and beyond the civil service test. So to me, it's always been quite confusing. If the purpose of the consent decree was to break up nepotism in pay details, nepotism or favoritism in pay details and assignments and promotions, why in the heck would they ever add a component to the testing above and beyond the civil service system, which is done all by experts outside the city, graded by experts outside the city? Why would the consent decree have ever added back in the local feel, which fuels the concern that friendships are taking care of friendships? Secondly, I think that Judge Morgan has done a tremendous job. I don't know how, if I was to testify in front of the judge, I would say that whenever a mayor interferes with the promotional practices, it usurps the chief of any power, formally or informally. In other words, if it is true that the mayor has engaged herself in this practice, and I don't know it to be true, but if it is true, it sends the message to everybody in the police department that the chief is not in charge. Third and final point, if you spent all the fall and spring preparing for this test and you spent all the summer sweating out the results of this test and then you're told summarily in a meeting that, never mind, it didn't matter, that destroys the morale of the people waiting to get promoted to major, the people waiting to get promoted to captain, the people waiting to get promoted to lieutenant, because it's a trickle-down effect. So once again, the judge has to be made aware that if it's true that the superintendent was overruled or parked to a decision constructed by the mayor, this guts the entire morale of the senior leadership who's supposed to be moving these advances forward.
So who decided that they were going to give the tests? That's what I'm trying to get back to here. This was the consent decree, or this was Chief Kirkpatrick that said, you know what, we're going to give tests, we're going to open promotions?
When we did the negotiation with the consent decree, the civil service rules were essentially exempted from any component of the consent decree. Uh-huh. So therefore, the civil service rules are those operated by the will of the department and the request of the chief. If you ask for a sergeant's examination, certain rules have to be have been met. Not difficult.
Wait, let me take a second, Chief. Let me slow you down for a second. So if it starts with the chief looking at the manpower and saying, superintendent looking at the manpower saying, we, or woman power, we need more sergeants, we need more this, we need more that. That's where it starts?
That's exactly where it starts. Okay. If an active list is in place, the superintendent is required to promote off of that list, whatever the conditions might be. If you don't have a list, you need a list, you call civil service. Civil service hires out-of-town experts who do these tests all over the country, Tommy. They do it all over the country. And then the civil service department examines the candidates. They bring in external policing experts of one rank higher than the ones who are being tested. They show those assessors what the test dimensions we're looking for. Those people who don't know anybody in the city of New Orleans create a list. When you add, that's the way it's been forever. But now that it appears that the consent decree for some reason added, and maybe I forgot, I don't remember it there when I was there, adding this internal review by deputy chiefs explodes all of that prior external expertise and external experience, because people are naturally going to say, Chief Jones didn't like me, that's why I went from number two to number five. And that rumor you can't overcome. You just can't overcome it in the culture. So basically the message to the people who wanted to be sergeants, lieutenants, captains, and majors that this kerfuffle has now resulted in their careers being held back by years. Now, how do you think that affects their morale to go out and carry out the agenda of the department?
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Ronald Serpas, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. I realize that was a rhetorical question. Traffic now, WWL. 826, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Ronald Serpas, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. On a lighter note, Chief, somebody texted and said, ironically, glitter was on a list of banned items for the Taylor Swift concert. It was a glitter-free event. So I guess you snuck in.
Well, Tommy, your history of being a rapscallion would suggest that you didn't pay attention to the rules, which is why I saw the glitter all over you. It was quite attractive.
Talk about never getting it.
Tommy, something occurred to me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think as long as Chief Kirkpatrick is here, she has always demonstrated that she is truthful and straightforward. Mm-hmm. If you were investigating this case, and maybe you were a federal judge who could make people answer questions, you would call Cantrell in and say, answer exactly what happened with this test, and then you would separately call in Kirkpatrick and ask her exactly what happened with this test, and you would judge the credibility of each and you'd make a decision. This is not hard stuff to do.
But what does that
it's
do
very
with the
simple.
But what does that do with a consent decree? Because the judge, Susie Morgan, can't fire the mayor. The mayor can fire
Go
ahead.
No, you're right, but imagine this. So if you determine that someone was interfering with the concept of the consent decree as the judge, you would have a duty to correct that behavior. And if it's true, we don't know. But if it's true that the officers do know that they don't know anything, that is true. That's one thing that they've been complaining about, and they have a right to complain. But if the mayor would be, in a hypothetical, if the mayor would be willing to interfere one of the most fundamental ways of altering culture for the future, wouldn't that make a difference to you to trust whether or not they're altering things that you just don't see? This is a big deal. That's why it became important. But what other things aren't being done correctly because of influence?
So if that's the case, I don't see an end to the consent decree while LaToya Cantrell is mayor. Is that what we're saying here?
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the whole Vapi investigation. Look at that whole issue there about the numerous examples of behaviors that were not consistent with typical, traditional, professional activity and investigations. And then if someone, we don't know yet, Tommy, but if just go put a sworn statement in front of the judge. No, I had nothing to do with it, Your Honor. I'm a mayor. I get blamed a lot of stuff. Nobody ever heard me say anything. That would be important to know for the morale of the men and women of the department. But what if it's the other way?
Yeah, the light went off.
Then
just
that
now
would say that the highest power in the city is, again, ignoring the concept of what the consent decree is supposed to fix.
You go to federal court, you put people under oath, and then you see what they have to say, right, at the risk of perjury.
That's exactly what I would do if I was the chief of police. I would do it under concern of their employer. I mean, I would investigate it. You can't not investigate this is the point. You can't have all these people's careers put on hold and not get to the bottom of it, whatever the bottom might be. Maybe Cantrell had nothing to do with it. fine, clear it up. Maybe neither of them had anything to do
but
with it,
did.
And it's a flaw in the consent decree.
But
fix
the,
it.
The there was no problem. I'm just reading what Rafael Goyeneche told Newell Norman. I believe this appears to be another example of retaliation. The mayor has no problem with the process. Mayor has a problem with the results and the results of the process that she created in 2021 and approved, I think. That was approved by the federal monitors, and they've been making promotions from, you know, since 2021 with no problems. So again, as I understand, just factually what happened is after the results of the test came back, which in no way were questioned as to the validity of it, the mayor saw who was on the list and at that point said that there's bias here?
I mean, that's one of the things that the officers are coming to the conclusion, because they have no other source of information, because people aren't being forced to say what they know. And there's only one person in the city can force the mayor to say anything, and that's the judge.
Under oath in federal court.
I mean, Tommy, the consent decree is meant to change forever the culture of the organization. To do so, you have to promote people into the new culture. They have to have confidence that the systems are working. And this is a clear example of something isn't working. And that is like dropping a brick in a pond. The ripples will go for years this kind of behavior.
The only reason I keep saying under oath in federal court is if that doesn't get your attention, I don't know what does. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Ronald Sirst, past professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD chief. So now it's up to Judge Susan Morgan, I guess, to see if she'll bring Mayor Cantrell in, put her under oath, see what happened. And as the chief just suggested, bring the superintendent in under oath separately. Tell me what happened. We'll take a break, come back, talk to a Louisiana state representative about Louisiana and reading the importance of that right now, a minute late. Time for WWL First News. All right, 8:46, 14 till 9. Quickly to Louisiana State Representative John Weibel. And one thing I often say, and if y'all listen to Tommy Tucker, WWL, is that nothing just happens. You know, the only time things get changed or when people get in there and do stuff. And Representative, good morning, first of all. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tommy, for having me, and especially for the spotlight on this critical issue for Louisiana.
And I always, you know, give the base example of, you know, even parent-teacher meetings, chairs got to get set up. Somebody's got to do that. So when it comes to improving reading in Louisiana, it's not just enough to talk about it. People have to get in there and do something to help. And that's what your organization is all about. Tell me about the focus on literacy first before we talk about results and how important it is, Representative, and how you got into it, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. I've worked with a number of nonprofit programs throughout my career that just really improves outcomes for communities, for our people, and particularly our students. The Center for Literacy and Learning has been really at the core of this issue for over 32 years. And what's very interesting about our organization is we're a Louisiana-based nonprofit, but our scope and our work is actually national. So we work with school districts, of course, across our state, but all over the country.
Tell me about your experience with this. Are you a former educator or on a school board? What's your history?
So, you know, I've been, of course, a community advocate. I did serve on a local school board prior to getting elected to the legislature. I started off my career through the LSU Ag Center, of all places, in extension service, working with our 4-H youth development programs, and being in all of the schools, having a presence in all of our schools in Washington Parish, it became evident even then that, you know, there were really some fundamental reform, systemic shifts we needed to make so we could improve student learning across our state. And literacy is one of those critical issues. It's, you know, we can continue to train and support teachers in the classroom, but when I came to the Center for Literacy and Learning 5.5 years ago, I said, you know, we're doing a great job of treating the symptoms. Now we really need to get focused on the root causes. And so we worked with the governor then, the legislature. We created the Literacy Commission. And then from there, we've had some extensive reforms that we're now seeing are paying off for our students across the state.
You know, I am a firm believer that this country still allows people to accomplish whatever it is that they want and be you know, I mean, not everybody's going to be, you know, Steve Jobs or one of these people or play professional basketball. But I do think this country, if you put yourself in a position, allows you to achieve a level of success. A lot of us get a lot of breaks, but it all starts with having the skills that you need. And if my kid's a teacher, third grade teacher, and they told me stories about students coming in at the third grade level that couldn't read, Representative. Now, what in the world are you supposed to do at that point?
Right. It's really a critical issue. And we know from birth to 8 years old that 90 to 95% of the brain has developed. And so that's why you hear so much focus on third grade reading performance. It's not that we're waiting, and we shouldn't wait, like in the case of your child's student, we shouldn't wait till third grade. But we know the research and the science tells us that fundamentally we have to have our students in a place where they're confident, they're foundationally strong in literacy, because from birth to 8 years old, you're learning to read so that you can read to learn the rest of your life. And that's really the premise of all the work that we do.
I learned so much just from reading books, and I hope we've not gotten completely away from that, because as you well know, Representative, I'm preaching the choir on this. You read this, you don't understand what that is, so you look it up, and then you learn, and then you read something else, you don't understand what that is, you look it up. Today, it's even more, it's easier than ever to look stuff up and learn, and it just exponentially expands your store of knowledge. Let me take a break. I want to talk specifically about the steps. You talk about three buckets your organization takes when it comes to helping kids read, all right?
Sounds great. Thank you.
John Weibel, our guest, Louisiana State Representative. He represents the Franklinton area, and scores are up when it comes to reading, which is good. Reading levels for kids, big improvement. 8:51, 9 till 9. Traffic now, WWL. All right, Tommy Tucker, 8:56 and a half. Quickly back to Representative John Weibel, who works hard to improve reading scores in Louisiana. And, I'm a conservative, and I believe people can pull themselves up by their bootstraps, but I'm realistic enough to know that you got to teach them what their bootstraps are and how to pull them up, and it all starts with reading. You go along with that, John?
You're spot on, Tommy. It's, you know, we have argued for a few years now, and we work very closely with the business and industry community across our state. Literacy, this is an economic development, a workforce development issue. You know, certainly we've got to do things to help working adults now build their skills, get into the workforce. But generationally, Tommy, we have been struggling in these areas. So generationally, to address workforce needs, it really starts at that third grade literacy spot. There's a lot of research we could get into another time, but everyone recognizes.
I would love to have you back, because I think this is very important. Tell me about, if we can, in the time we have left, talk about the work the center does, and you talk about it in three buckets, right?
That's exactly right. We do a lot of professional development with educators and providers from child care centers all the way to K-12. Our second bucket is family engagement. We have to meet parents and families where they are and help give them the tools to read to their children. Remember, we're dealing with generational issues and challenges here. And the third bucket is the advocacy. You know, we have a lot of shiny new objects in education reform, which are very good reforms, but the tried and true reform is making sure that by end of third grade, our children are strong and confident readers, and they're grounded in those literacy principles so they can be successful for the rest of their lives.
You know, the generational thing, I think, is something that gets overlooked sometimes, because you might be talking about parents that can't read as well, correct?
Correct. We struggle, and we have resources and programs where we help parents and support them to work with their children. And then the other thing, you know, I always say one of my primary talking points is, you know, if you were not read to as a child, then I don't think it's a safe assumption that you will intuitively read to your children. And so rather than, you know, point fingers and all of these other things, going back to what we talked about earlier, it's really let's meet our parents where they are. Let's lift them up and let's encourage them and educate them on just how valuable that reading piece is. 10 minutes a day, 15 minutes a day. We're not asking you to be a rocket scientist or an engineer, researcher, or any of those things. Just engage with your child. Read whatever is of interest to you and the child, and that engagement will go a very long way in creating that strong foundation for that child's learning throughout life.
John, I want you to come back. I think what you're doing is extremely important. Congratulations on it. You're not pounding the table. You're getting stuff done and showing results.
It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get four 5G phones on us and four lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll be back. Around the stretch we come, making our way home, 9 o'clock hour, and I'm looking at the NFL schedule, and Sean Payton's Broncos, who are 5-3, take on Jim Harbaugh's, I got him right? Ravens. I just want to make sure I had the right Harbaugh. Ravens, who are also 5-3, who is it, John? Yeah, Jim is with the Chargers. So, you play a little bit. So anyway, here's what I'm thinking. Imagine this, if you will, and we're a long way from any of this happening. I just want to see what kind of emotional response this elicits in you. Imagine Sean Payton bringing his Broncos to play in the Super Bowl here in New Orleans in February. What kind of emotional response would that elicit from you? Well, with that in mind, Jason Lantner joins us, our friend, professor of psychology at Kutztown University, to talk about sports psychology and why we get so wrapped up in the teams and it becomes so emotional. How you doing, Professor?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back on. You know, I'm watching a Saints game a while back. I forgot which one it is now, and they have a little rally going. I'm thinking they're coming back, and the kicker misses the extra point, and I swear to goodness I got nauseated, physically nauseated. I'm watching the LSU game Saturday night, and Garrett Nussmeier had a rough night. And again, I'm just pacing up. And I watch football alone. I don't like to have any company because I like to pay attention to it. But I'm talking and screaming and getting all emotional. Why, Professor, do we get so invested in sports teams when, with free agency, with name, image, and likeness, be it professional or college football, it is like Seinfeld once said, we're rooting for the uniforms, not the people, because sometimes we don't even know who the people are.
Great question. Tommy, please know that you are not alone in the way that you embrace and respond to sports, for that matter.
Okay.
So when we're talking about the idea of sport fandom, the key idea is we have this social identity and we're connected to the team. And as you say, like we're connected to the uniform. Sometimes it is a player. Sometimes it's the coaches, as you mentioned, Sean Payton. Mm-hmm. But we're really connected to the team, and that could be something that we grow up with, whether it's regional, whether we watch parents or uncles or older siblings or whoever they kind of root for is what we adopt. And then that team becomes really a part of our persona. We're connected to them. So their wins are our highs and their losses are our lows. And we take them to heart and we respond in certain ways. So it is a lot of really self-esteem maintenance, if you will, of how we emotionally as well as psychologically respond to the competitions and not just the outcomes, but also the different types of plays throughout the competition as well.
Self-esteem maintenance, you say?
Yeah, so when we think about the idea of being connected to a team, we know that it's important for us, as with any individual, to maintain positive self-esteem, and we can sort of fluctuate how we perceive or psychologically adjust to that. So, for example, research has shown that when, you know, the team that you root for, we'll just say our team, when the team that you root for, and we'll just say LSU right now, when they win, people respond more affirmatively that we won when they talk about the past weekend. And please understand, these are people who are not on the team.
We didn't have a damn thing to do with it. We had nothing to do with any of it.
Exactly. But by saying that we won, you're connecting yourself to that victory, which boosts your self-esteem and the way that you feel about yourself. Now, we can also psychologically distance ourselves. So if LSU loses, and people may say, how did the team do this weekend? They may say, or likely to say, that same fan, well, they lost. And by saying they lost, they're disconnecting themselves from that negativity of that loss to still maintain some positivity about their self-esteem and the way they feel about themselves.
Is that a common thing? We won, they lost?
Yeah, you can hear it all the time. Just talk to your friends. And a lot of times they do it. I'll call people out on it. Like, they talk like the we won thing. I was like, really? I didn't see you playing this past weekend. And that's more easy to identify. But they lost is a little bit, it's more subtle at times. But if you pay attention to conversations and you hear people talk about it, you go to a bar on a Sunday and listen to NFL games, you feel the emotions that people experience at the moment, and then maybe you get the follow-up from college football Saturdays at the same time to see how people are connecting. Because maybe their college team lost on a Saturday, but now their NFL team is doing well. They can also shift their identity from the college team to the NFL team to still feel okay about who they are.
You got the giggle of truth out of me on that one, because I just thought about how many times I said we won, but they lost, man, they suck. They're terrible. But really, because it was we when they were playing well. We sacked them. We did this, but they did that. What about the bandwagon effect or whatever it is? There are different, I guess, levels of buy-in for fans emotionally, and what is it that causes some to – are any there, win or lose? Or is that the minority, and most people, they like a winner and they attach onto that?
Well, I think it goes back to kind of what type of fan people are, because there are people who are diehards. Like, they're going to stick with the team through the thick and through the thin, for that matter. They're going to stick through all the potentially losing seasons, all the winning seasons. I mean, Cubs fans and Red Sox fans are great examples of that. They had rabid fan bases for years and years and years and years and decades and decades, and then they finally did become victorious and win World Series. But then there are some who are just, they're fans, but they're more fans for the social engagement of the action. They're not as tied into the competition as they are to the sort of the camaraderie and the family atmosphere, being with their other friends or family members who are fans of that particular team. So there are sort of, as you say, there are different levels of engagement that a fan can have with the team. Obviously, in some way, those who are really committed decades or decades, years after years, are going to be more psychologically and emotionally connected to the team because of the way that they sort of buy in. And then you mentioned the idea of a bandwagon. I mean, bandwagon, you think about it, just go back to psychological self-esteem, is that they're jumping on to a winner in some way because it helps them feel better about themselves by having a close connection to something that's very positive.
When it comes to sports, do people react differently to more sports? Are some more emotional than others?
Oh, of course. I mean, there are always individual differences in how we respond to anything on a day-to-day basis. And so the more committed that we are to this identity as being a fan of a particular team, the more likely we're going to have a more severe emotional response to the outcome. Of a play, of a competition, of a championship, whatever it may be. And the people who are not as committed are not going to have as severe of an emotional response to it. It's just, it's simply the way in which, and I don't want to say that we're hardwired, but it's the way that we're psychologically wired to respond or interpret, perceive, or understand the meaning of that particular competition, or the meaning of that social connection to who we are as a person.
Perhaps I phrased that poorly. What I was trying to ask is, are baseball fans necessarily less passionate than football fans, less passionate than soccer fans, or does it all depend?
I think it all depends. You're going to have different different cultures and different fan bases. Up where I'm at, Philadelphia is widely regarded as one of the more interesting, shall we say, fan bases across the nation. And that goes for Eagles fans, for Flyers fans, for Phillies fans. Mm-hmm. And so different cities have different levels of fandom, what the expectations are. The Raiders in the NFL, the Vegas Raiders, mm-hmm. They have a very particular fan base. And there are their expectations in some way. If you think about a sport fan culture, whether we're talking American football, football known internationally, soccer for that matter, baseball, hockey, whatever it is, there are different expectations for what it means to be a fan of a particular team because of the cultural norms or standards with that particular team.
Has the proliferation of gambling and legalization of sports betting changed this equation at all?
I think it's, I'm not sure if it's changed the psychological connection to the teams. I think it's changed the way in which people are consuming the games. And by that, I mean how they're focusing on what is happening in the game from a play-to-play standpoint. And I hear so many people talking about, well, I don't care who wins, but I need so-and-so to do really well, because they're you know, picking a particular player in fantasy league, or they're gambling in some way based on that. So I think it becomes more focused on the player level from the monetary financial standpoint, but I'm not sure if it's altering their psychological connection to a particular team.
I guess what I was wondering, you know, you can bet at so many different things. You can bet point spreads, you can bet totals. So if you bet on the total of the game and somebody's got $100 on the line and they're a rabid Saints fan, say, but it means that the other team's going to have to score for them to win their bet, is it a win-win situation or a lose-lose situation for them?
And I think that goes to the psychological maintenance that we can do. So how are we adjusting how we interpret that? Is it going to be that we're focused more on the overall connection to the team, or are we going to focus more on that individual person, which the performance might give you a financial boost, but you're not necessarily psychologically tied to that individual as much as you are to the team?
Maybe you offset it.
Like the financial gain is good, and it may play off the potential, negative social connection if the team were to lose.
I wonder if the terminology would be, we won the game, but I lost my bet.
it could be. I know they talk a lot about this idea. So I mentioned like the idea of self-esteem maintenance. So there's the idea of basking in reflected glory called birging, B-I-R-G-I-N-G. So basking in reflected glory is the we part of it. There's also corfing, which is cutting off reflected failure. So C-O-R-F-I-N-G would be the, you know, distancing yourself after a particular loss. So yeah, there could be something that would need to be investigated more about how the idea of fantasy league and gambling has sort of altered sort of the experience of what fandom is from a team perspective.
Where does peer pressure fit into this? Because I'll see people every now and then, I'll wonder if they're from out of town, expatriates or whatever, from, you know, with the 49ers logo on a rear window of the car or whatever. You don't see a lot of, divisional rivals, but, or you might see some, as you said, some Eagles fans with the gear and so forth. Do people, when they move to other places, generally speaking, because what's the old thing, Professor, groups are predictable, individuals are not, do they generally assimilate and adopt a new home team? Because I saw a bunch of Saints jerseys at the Chargers game, and I don't know if it's people that traveled there or not. Or do they take the team with them, or do they take on the team where they move?
If I was a betting man to go with the theme here, I would say that they take the team with them for the most part, because it's really an ingrained part of who they are, that particular social identity. And if they're really a fan of a team, there's a historical nature of that connection that could stem from growing up in the family and watching stuff with mom or dad or attending games on the weekends. And so it's probably unlikely that they may give up that particular social connection, that fandom. But they could also potentially start to adopt the local team. Like, there's nothing against that. And then it becomes a challenge if those two team plays, who do you root for? And that's a whole different question. But I think for the most part, they're going to be keeping those social connections. They're going to keep that original team and maybe dip their toes in a bit to experience what that fandom is for that new culture.
Yeah, I found interesting last night they had a couple of Yankees fans ejected after they ripped the ball out of the glove of a Dodgers outfielder. But that's in direct contrast to what happened in Chicago with that poor guy with the Cubs, right, that interfered with the catch. Well, I don't need to bring up his name again. Tim's telling me his name in my ear. I think that poor man suffered enough. I don't think I need to bring up his name again. But it is a big contrast there, and that kind of speaks to a lot of what we're talking about, huh?
Yeah, and I think it's acknowledging I'm not sure if it's like commitment to the team or, you know, why would you rip the ball out of a player's hand just to have the ball? And not knowing the outcome, the consequence, obviously, that they got. But does that demonstrate the level of your commitment to being a Yankees fan by doing that, by actually interfering in the gameplay? I don't know. And I wonder how other Yankees fans actually perceive that. Is that really purposeful? Like, yay, way to go, you're a big fan? Or it's like, no, you don't need to do that. You can still be a fan and appreciate good play by the other team. And that doesn't downplay what your team is doing.
And then I would think if you had a bet on that particular play or whatever, then that would factor into it as well. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Because in order to expand to here, Professor, first of all, there was a story back in Psychology Today about some research indicating that when NFL teams lose, domestic violence increases, and how what kind of ripple effect that can have. And also I wanted to see if any of this extends out, you know, with election day next Tuesday, to political parties, where it seems as if political parties have morphed into teams. You know, we talk about red and blue, so you got team colors, right? And I don't know if it's about ideology or it's about we or them and winning or losing. We'll talk about it when we come back. And if it's the same thing when it comes to politics, if, say, the election next Tuesday, if you're a Republican and Donald Trump loses and you say, well, Trump lost, but we this, or if Harris wins or loses, then you say just the opposite. We'll talk when we come back. Interesting conversation. Professor Jason Lanter, professor of psychology at Kutztown University, sports psychologist. Are you emotionally tied into the Saints, LSU? Do you get physically sick when something bad happens? Text me at 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. Talking to our friend Dr. Jason Lanter, professor of psychology at Kutztown University, about how we get so emotionally invested in teams and get so fired up and so angry if they lose. It can increase domestic violence, especially in cases of upsets. How would you suggest to people that they keep it in perspective, doctor?
That is a great question, and not one that is easily solved for that matter.
Let me interrupt for a second. What about you? You're a sports psychologist. You live in Philly, so I would imagine you got some ties to one of the teams, right, or all of them?
Well, I actually don't, because I'm an academic transplant. I grew up in the Midwest, so I have like
so
a
who'd you bring with
Chicago
you?
Bears connection.
Okay, there
Pardon?
You go. All right.
There you go.
But anyway, so go ahead. How do you keep it in perspective?
I think that the biggest thing is trying to talk to an individual and see, like, if you want to, you can really ask them, why is this so important to you? What do you get from it? And sometimes they may struggle to really explain that connection that they have and why it is so meaningful to them. I mean, we know, because I watch games and we feel like that the little butterflies in the stomach at tense moments if you're connected to a team, sort of as you were saying, like with the game this past weekend. Mm-hmm. But I think it is challenging to purposely distance ourselves from something that is so meaningful to us. That is not an easy psychological process, to be able to be unbiased and more rational and logical in our thinking when our emotions are very high. And that's just life. That's just our humanity in some way. So it's not easy to really disentangle that, to really set emotions aside, to really think about, okay, I'm connected to this team, but really it's just sort of, dare I say, for fun. I don't get anything back from it in how much I've invested. I'm actually probably spending more money for that matter. But how do I process it better so I'm making better sense or appropriate sense of what this outcome truly means to me as an individual in my day-to-day life?
Do you see anybody having fun here? Would be something that could be heard around living rooms in the afternoons on Saturdays or Sundays. Somebody texted in and said, please ask Dr. Lanter, why I get so upset watching the games, but then the players themselves who were playing in the games are laughing and talking and hugging each other after the game is over.
Yeah, so it's always interesting to see that sort of jovial nature, especially like after, you know, very aggressive football games. For that
gut-wrenching loss, a gut-wrenching loss. You're eating your guts out, right? You're dying, and then they're hugging each other and laughing.
Mm-hmm. And you wonder how much they're able to turn it off and turn it on in terms of like the emotions on the field, the emotion once the whistle is over, like the game is over. And as professionals, that's part of what they have to do, is they have to have a better self-regulatory ability to perform at that level, to be able to have the emotions hit when they hit, and then to be able to calm them down, to be able to participate, to be able to play well. And they may have to do the same thing once the competition is over, like know that it's over. Or maybe they're just very well at masking it, covering it, because they want to go talk to their friend who they played with in college who's now on the opposite team. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're making plans for later on when they want to get together and hang out and catch up. But for us, the regular fans, we haven't had necessarily the purposeful, learning to be able to regulate those emotions and to be able to turn them on and turn them off, because we may have the water cooler conversation the day after. Oh, why did they do this? Or why did they do that? Oh, they should have made this call. And that may continue to go over in our mind, which is then going to, perpetuate those emotions that we experienced.
And I guess I would add that they're getting paid either way, and we're not getting paid because our payoff is emotional, right?
Yeah, obviously from the business end of things, it is a business when you're really looking at the professional level. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of them recognize it, especially when they're veterans in their sport, that they recognize the business end of things, to enjoy it for what it is. And once it's over, once that final whistle is done, that final whistle is done. And it's not saying that it's easy, like they don't take losses hard. I'm sure they take them really, really hard. But they're probably very good at controlling those emotional responses, regulating the way that they feel, at least in public, about it.
You know, and as we have this conversation, I'm thinking maybe part of that could be just an emotional release of, hey, you know what, I can still walk. Seriously. Because you go into a game not knowing, right?
Yeah, I'm still amazed on a week-to-week basis the lack of severe injuries in NFL and college football. Based on the size and the speed and the ferocity with which that is played.
The physics
alone.
So
maybe there is an appreciation for the players for that.
The physics alone, with the force and the mass and the velocity, I'm right there with you, Doctor. I don't know how. I really don't. I don't know how people aren't carried off. I guess it's the training and it's big, fast, strong people hitting big, fast, strong people. I asked you earlier about political parties, and I don't know if there's any kind of change in that or it's always been that way. You got team colors, red or blue. You got a mascot, a donkey or an elephant. Has the same emotion kind of shifted from sports to politics? Has it always been there, or has it come from politics to sports, or am I just making stuff up in my head? Because I do that sometimes as well.
No, I think you're making a great kind of carryover of the idea about social identity. I've been interested in the idea of the political parties and affiliation, and you can call them teams for that matter, as you talk about red and blue and donkey and elephant. And so we sort of make this idea that, also recognize that there are more than two political parties, but it's really two major players in American politics. And so when we think about this idea, and going back to sports, we'll just continue to talk football. Football has, at this point, we have the BCS in college, and then we have the Super Bowl in the NFL. And these are major, major championships each year. They're annual. When you talk about U.S. politics, the major, major quote-unquote championship, if you want to refer to it as that, is really the presidential election every 4 years. Yes, there are midterm elections, but those do not get as much publicity, dare I say. They don't get as much coverage as what we do for these major presidential elections. You add in the fact that our country is probably more divided than ever, more kind of polarized than ever with regard to the rhetoric amongst the two major candidates. And it does make for a we-them dichotomy, depending on which side you fall and how you feel that you identify with, what you affiliate with, for that matter. I am really intrigued at your idea or your proposed idea that what's going to happen next Wednesday. How are people going to respond to the election, that this we-they approach, or you say the name, like Harris lost or Harris won or Trump lost or Trump won, or we won or we lost. Because that will be purposeful. And I think, you mentioned you're now aware of it, that you say we a lot. It's really subtle at times how people use this self-esteem maintenance approach simply by changing the terminology, the words they use, to help them feel okay about themselves and sometimes better about themselves.
Because it seems like when you get right down to it, it's really not about ideology. It's about winning or losing when it comes to politics with a lot of people, is it not?
It is. You definitely want to be on the winning side, but at the same time, that winning side is connected to who you are. But I think politics is different than sports because politics, at least right now, it's the idea that that outcome is not just immediate. That outcome is for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so there's a longer term connection to that loss, if you will, or that win, if you will, than what we would experience with sports, because sports, we have another opportunity that's going to start, let's say, 6 months from now. But with the presidential election, we don't have another opportunity in 6 months. It's going to be another 3 years before you have another opportunity to get that new person who may move forward with the party, for that matter.
And I guess when it comes to policy, so much of it is nuanced. It's not you score or you don't. It's not red, it's not blue, it's purple, really, when you get right down to the problems we have in this country and what are the ways to solve them. And, you know, I was saying the other day, earlier this morning, rather, that I had to block about 8 friends because I got tired of getting the text whenever their candidate, one or the other, breaks wind. It's either it smells like roses or it stinks, depending on what side of the echo chamber you're on. And I got tired of hearing it because, to me, now we're in the stage of the presidential race like the Super Bowl pregame show. And if Bill Cowher picks the Steelers, then you love him. If Michael Strahan picks the Giants, then you love him. Neither of which has anything to do with who's going to vote for anybody or the outcome of the game, but I guess we just look for something before the actual game takes place.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is interesting. Like both candidates sort of made their major final speeches last night, one right near me, for that matter. And it's interesting that you propose it sort of as like the Super Bowl pregame show, which is almost getting to be about a week long at this point.
Because you know what, Professor, you look at now they're talking about the excruciating minutiae, right? Just like in hour three of the Super Bowl pregame show.
Yeah, they're covering all the details, and it's really for those people who have not made up their minds, which I'm still on some level amazed that there are people who have not made up their mind on the election at this point. But it is. It gives us more time, and then if you're going to pay attention to the political pundits at this point to give you information, all the information is out there. So you're sort of working on the process to decide which team you're on, or you're on the team that you're on, and you're dedicated, you're stuck, and no matter what you hear, it's not going to change.
Love talking to you, Professor. Thank you. I appreciate your time. Jason Lanter, Professor of Psychology at Kutztown University. We'll take a quick break. Speaking of emotional investment, talk to Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Whenever a player goes... ...9:47, quickly to Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. I'm Tommy Tucker on WWL. Jeff, tell me about Derek Carr and the likelihood of, first of all, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Tommy. How are you?
Right. How was the trip to L.A.? Good? Other than, you know.
Oh, yeah, game? It was nice. It was nice. The great weather, and then we went and watched a really, really unfortunate football game.
It was hard to watch, I'm telling you. It really was, but I'm looking ahead to better things. Derek Carr, well, no, but really, I mean, you look at what's going on in Cincinnati, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but they got Joe Burrow. You look at what's going on in, where else was it? I mentioned that struggling, they got the quarterback. They got their quarterback, so it could be –
Jets, probably.
Trevor Lawrence, yeah, that's what it was, the Jaguars. Or okay. The Jets, either way, right? So, but we didn't have our quarterback. Hopefully we'll get him back on Sunday. Thoughts? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the expectation is that he gets out to practice later today, and ideally, you know, if things go well, he'll play. He had throwing sessions last week. He had another throwing session on Monday. Dennis Allen said it was about 50 throws. And then kind of how he bounces back from that, how his body kind of feels kind of coming back from that and going through a couple days of practice is going to be a big thing. But, yeah, I think the hope is that he's out there and you can try to start to get this thing turned around. Like, I think it's easy to lose perspective of the last 3 weeks in the sense of, like, man, this is a 6-game losing streak. Mm-hmm. You know, the first 3 games of that losing streak, while bad, were was a picture of a team that was kind of right there and just needed to figure out how to win games. Mm-hmm. The Kansas City game notwithstanding, it's the last 3 weeks where you've been relying on a rookie quarterback who I think probably just wasn't ready to be thrown into that situation, that it really, really got away from you. And in large part because you just couldn't put points on the board. You know, if you take away that second quarter against the Bucs, which was largely about, hey, the defense is forcing turnovers and giving the offense really good opportunities to score. I mean, you're talking about an offense that's put up 19 points in the other 11 quarters of football, and I'm taking away the safety. from that. So, you know, if you can get an offense to go out there and score some points, you know, that'll make life easier on your defense. Because I think you go to that Chargers game and you say, hey, the big complaint about our defense was we couldn't stop the run. We stopped the run in that game, right? You kept points off the board. I don't think the Chargers scored in the first quarter of that game. Like, so you gave your offense a chance. They weren't able to take advantage. You'd hope that if you put Derek Carr back in there, you're a little more functional and you can take advantage of some of those things. Especially going out to Carolina should be a win. You know, there's, you know, if the Saints are one of the worst teams in the league, which the last 3 weeks would make you believe, they're not worse than the Panthers. The Panthers are the 32nd best team in this NFL right now. So, you know, you go win a game and then you see if you can string some more together after that. But yeah, I think the idea is you're going to get Derek Carr back and things are going to start to look a little bit better.
Do we know anything about Pete Werner or not? Did he get nicked up?
No. Yeah, it looked like he came off the field with some sort of discomfort after that. You know, he missed that interception late in the game. Looked like he went down kind of awkwardly. It didn't seem like it was – so he was dealing with a hamstring injury prior to that. It didn't look like he was dealing with anything hamstring-related. So we'll have to see on the injury report today exactly what he's listed with. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, we don't know exactly what it was. It doesn't seem like anything significant, though.
Yeah, I think – not to us, but I think I know maybe what it seems like what it was, but we don't need to talk about that. Let's talk about you know what I'm saying, the Saints wide receivers – you don't really have a star out there, do you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought Chris Olave had a really solid game. You know, he had to get 8 catches, 107 yards in his first game, going over 100 yards. He was able to get out of the game without a concussion, so that's always a nice thing because there was a point in that game where we thought he might have had a concussion because his first catch of the game he got unloaded on.
I got to correct myself, Jeff, because, again, it goes to who's throwing the ball, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Chris didn't really play either of the first two starts with Spencer, so it's tough to put that on him, right? Because he caught a pass, got concussed, missed the rest of that game, missed the next game. So, yeah, I mean, you'd hope that you can kind of build on that. You know, he didn't exactly blow anything up from a receiving perspective when Derek was in there, so we'll see how that goes. But, no, I mean, without Rashid, you know, you're going to have to rely on him a lot more. I'm hopeful that you can continue to get the tight ends involved. We'll have to see Kendre Miller in terms of can he play. You know, he dealt with the hamstring injury in camp. Now he has a hamstring injury to the other leg. So hopefully it's not as significant as that previous one, and it's not going to keep him out for an extended period of time, but we'll have to wait and see. But, no, I think the playmakers on offense, you're definitely, you know, you don't have enough. Let's put it that way. It doesn't seem like you have enough. And we'll have to see what they do in terms of Marquez Valdes-Scantling. He was added to the roster last week. He did not play. You know, it's tough to learn an offense in 4 to 5 days and go out there and execute. So we'll have to see if maybe this week he's able to pick that up and get out there against the Panthers. And that'll give you a little bit more of a deep threat than you've had. Right now you're kind of relying on Mason Tipton in that role. And as much as the team likes Mason Tipton, it's, you know, you're relying on a UDFA and a key role of your offense. That's not ideal. So we'll have to see. But no, I think when you look at the offense, the playmakers are not there. Like, you don't have the level of playmakers that you'd like at this point.
And real quick, before we let you go, not just playmakers, but it seemed like watching the game, I got the feel that every time somebody had a chance to step up and make a play, they didn't. If you want to talk about the dropped interception, whatever, it just seems like every time they had a chance, they were close but didn't do it. Do you get the idea that maybe once this team, once people start stepping up and make plays, that it gets contagious?
You'd hope. And yeah, the defensive backs on contested catches was definitely a problem in that game. Yeah, you were in position multiple times. The ball got completed over your head. You know, those are kind of those 50-50 opportunities that they're 50-50 for a reason. They could go either way. You need to win, you know, enough of those to swing the result. And they just didn't. I mean, every chance they had, it seemed, to make a play in a key moment didn't get made, and the Chargers made them. So that's how you lose games.
I'm optimistic. We'll see. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your time as always. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. And I'll say it again, if y'all are not turning down that sound and listening to Mike Haas and Deuce and Jeff on the sideline, you're missing out. Taking a break, coming back, finding out what Newell's got for us today on WWL.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.